Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 154. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at murderous French women. First off, there's going to be the 1968 François Truffaut movie based on a novel by Conor Woolridge, and that is The Bride Wore Black, starring Jean Moreau. Then we go to 1994, Luc Besson's La Femme Nikita, also known as Nikita, starring Anne Perelow, and again Jean Moreau.
Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it.
How's everybody going? The weather here is still summery. Summer turned up a bit late here in Melbourne, but it's definitely hit now. Yesterday was about 35°C, today's about 23. It's jumping all over the place. I had a lovely walk this morning along the beachfront, did about 4 kilometres along there, so I'm doing fine. I'm pumped, I'm ready to go, and I have a couple of very cool films to talk about this time around. But, things are interesting here in Australia as well. As long-time listeners may know, I'm a bit of a political wonk, and our monstrously bad Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, is currently on the ropes. There's going to be a spill for all of the positions in the for the Prime Minister's position among the conservative politicians in the Liberal Party tomorrow, in fact. And Tony Abbott, who is hated as a politician to a greater extent than probably any politician that I've lived through in Australian history, looks like either now or in a few months he is going to get the sack. And the Twitterati and the bloggers and the journalists are really analysing this great. There's some really good quality journalism and some very eloquent journalism coming out about this. And being the political wonk that I am, I'm loving it. There is a lot of schadenfreude in that, taking delight in someone else's misery. But the mean-spiritedness of this government, particularly our prime monster, really does lead you towards schadenfreude on a roller coaster. But anyway, I'm enjoying that. I've watched a few good movies lately as well, which is always a bit of fun. And I'm looking forward to watching a few more in the next week or two. So what actually have I been watching? Before I do that, I should tell you that I've got some equipment changes here in the Frost Man Cave. And I've upgraded from the laptop I was using to do the podcast to an Asus all-in-one PC. So basically the screen and the PC are all of one piece. Keyboard and mouse are separate and that kind of thing. But I'm kind of enjoying it. It's got a bigger screen than the laptop I've been using. And I kind of like the format of an all-in-one PC. It doesn't take up much desk space. And with all the shit I've got on my desk, that's always at a premium. But, I kind of enjoyed it. I've been setting it up this week and getting all of the new, all of the software I need on there and checking things out, putting through about 1,200 Windows updates. It's crazy the amount of Windows updates you have to put onto a new Windows PC. And in general, kind of doing all the wonky tech stuff to get things ready for this recording. But anyway, the stuff I've been watching, let's talk about that, because I've been talking about politics and computer technology, and it's probably time I talked about movies. Probably not going to do as many movies this year as I've done in the past couple of years. We're well into February, and I've only seen 44 films so far, most of which have been rewatches, but there have been a few new ones, which is always fun. Liz Travaskis and I did, for the radio gig, Charade, the Stanley Donen film with Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn in it, so we had a bit of fun watching that and enjoying it. In the public domain, that film, because, and this is the wonderful story of it, because somebody left off a proper copyright notice on the film when it was originally released. So it immediately dive-bombed into the public domain. There are any number of different versions of it out there of varying qualities. In fact, the studio has released it on DVD and Blu-ray. But kind of made for a little bit extra to talk about with that one. I also saw Birdman, the movie with Michael Keaton in it, the magic realism South American style movie about an actor who formerly played a superhero in a movie series who's gone to New York to adapt a Raymond Carver story into a play. And it's the story of him making that play and the things that go on while he's trying to get it up. He's put his own money up for it. He's got difficulties with actors and women and all sorts of things. And it's a great film. It's cut so it looks like it's all done in one take. And it wasn't done in one take. There are lots of trickery bits, some of which date back as far as Hitchcock's Rope to hide the fact that it wasn't done in one take. But I enjoyed the film. I'll probably revisit that one at some stage in the future and just watch it again to fully absorb it. But it's definitely one of the good films for 2015. And I really enjoyed watching it. And Michael Keaton is superb in it. Zach Galifianakis does a role that's not one of his usual dopey roles. And it's good to see that as well. Naomi Watts is in it. Ed Norton's in it. And he wasn't as unlikable as he has been in other films. So I definitely recommend Birdman. It's a good watch. So Liz got sick this week. And so I couldn't do the radio gig with her this week. So instead, Paul Cerratore in Alice Springs. And I did Jackie Brown, the Quentin Tarantino movie from 1997, starring Pam Grier and Robert Forster and Samuel L. Jackson and Michael Keaton again, Robert De Niro, Bridget Fonda. And we had a bit of fun with it. Unfortunately, Paul watched it late at night and fell asleep part of the way through it because he just had a full-on day and they sprung on him at the last moment that he'd be doing this gig with me and doing the evening session at ABC Local Radio Northern Territory. And so we had a bit of a discussion around whether he should watch it again when he's a little more awake. And he had a little bit of a problem with some of the slower pieces in there, particularly the bit where Jackie and Max Cherry, played by Robert Forster, were talking about making coffee and stuff like that in her apartment. And I said, it's not about the dialogue. Forget the dialogue in that scene. It's about the looks between them and that growing attraction they have for each other, which is very subtly done for Tarantino in that particular scene. So I did go to bat for it. I think it's one of Tarantino's best from some viewpoints. And we really had a bit of fun talking about it because Paul's a nice movie one. He comes at it from a slightly different viewpoint than I do, being somewhat younger. And it was a nice little session and I quite enjoyed having a chat with him about it. I love it when there's a little bit of disagreement and then I go into evangelical mode and try to talk people around about a particular film. It's an instinctive thing with me. I don't know whether it's a good or a bad quality, but it's something that I do. Of course, I've seen the two movies for this podcast, so I won't talk about them. And I just finished watching a movie that's been recommended to me by some people over at The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema and Silver and Gold and a few of the other Facebook interfaces for those particular podcasts. And that is the Keanu Reeves movie John Wick, which I enjoyed a lot. I mean, I like a good action film, as everyone knows, as much as anybody else, and I think it really does work well. It works well particularly because it's very knowing. There are references to any number of other films. There are references to mythologies in there as well. And it's got a kick-ass cast apart from Keanu Reeves. It's got Michael Nyquist, who people remember from the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo movies. It's also got Adrian Palicki in it. We've got some Ian McShane in there. We've got some Lance Reddick in there. We've also got some Willem Dafoe. So, yeah, it really works well. Filmed in New York and really a very widescreen format. I kind of liked that widescreen. It worked well for me. And it's got tons of good action stuff in it. It does reference things like Le Samurai and The Red Circle and a few other films like that, but it doesn't lose anything for that as well. And if you haven't seen it, it is right up there with maybe top 75% of action films of recent times because it does have some character-based stuff in it that's really useful. So that's about all I've been watching as far as movies are concerned. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a break now. And when I go back, we're going to talk about some François Truffaut from 1968 Film starring Jean Moreau, based on a Cornell Woolrich novel, which I highly recommend to everybody, and that is The Bride Wore Black. Now, I'm going to play a song sung by Jean Moreau because I'm in a Jean Moreau kind of mood, and then when I get back, I'm going to talk about the movie.
Plante ce couteau minette, mets droit au cœur s'il te plaît, la besogne à moitié faite et les meurtres incomplets font horreur à la monnette qui n'aspire qu'au parfait, qui n'aspire qu'au parfait. Parfait, parfait. Les couteaux à cran d'arrêt n'ont cureux des pâquerettes. L'homme dort comme un boulet. Plantez ce couteau minette. La nuit saoule de planète ne se souviendra jamais. Ne se souviendra jamais. Jamais. Jamais, jamais. Droit au cœur discret, qui dans son profond palais sait mourir sans chansonnette, plante ce couteau minette, la nuit saoule de planète ne se souviendra jamais, ne se souviendra jamais. Jamais, jamais, jamais ne se souviendra. Jamais.
That was Jean Moreau with a song called Chanson à tuer, which means song killing. And given the fact that Jean Moreau isn't a particularly good singer, I think that's kind of apt. And given that we're talking about her in the context of a vengeful murderer, it seemed kind of apt to play that one for you. So on to The Bride Wore Black. I'm not going to try to pronounce the French title because even though I am kind of dabbling with learning French, my accent is fucking abysmal. So I'm not going to try to. It's based on a 1940 novel by a very fine crime writer called Cornell Woolrich, who produced works that were adapted into a ton of movies. Things like The Leopard Man, Phantom Lady, Black Angel, Fear in the Night, Night Has a Thousand Eyes, Rear Window, dig it, Rear Window. This one, Mississippi Mermaid, which was also by Truffaut, was made a year after The Bride Wore Black. And Original Sin, the one with Antonio Banderas and Angelina Jolie from 2001. So, you know, he's got a great track record. And the novels are great. I've got a number of them here. There's an omnibus edition of four of his novels, which I'm really going to have to reread soon because I do like Cornell Woolrich's work and I want to go back and revisit it. So The Bride Wore Black, I'll give you a brief précis of it. And the plot is fairly simple. And this is from Wikipedia, by the way. It's a revenge film in which a widowed woman hunts down the five men who killed her husband on her wedding day. She methodically kills each of the men using various methods and dressing only in white or black or both. And the cast is fine. Jean Moreau plays Julie Kohler, the bride, of course. Michel Bouquet is in it as one of the victims. Jean-Claude Brialy, Charles Denner, Michael Lonsdale, and Serge Rousseau. The music's by Vivaldi and Bernard Herrmann. Now, there's a reason why they got Bernard Herrmann to do the music, and that is just before he made The Bride Wore Black, Francois Truffaut did an epic thing and sat down with Alfred Hitchcock and recorded long conversations about each of Hitchcock's movies, which were turned into a book. When I did The Birds recently, I used that as a reference work for the research that I did on The Birds. And it was a difficult thing for them to record, too, because Truffaut's English was rudimentary and Hitchcock's French was pretty much the same. So they worked through a translator and that made it a much more complex thing. But if you can get a copy of Francois Truffaut's book on Hitchcock, it's well worth doing. And saying that, having said that, this movie, The Bride Wore Black, is his Hitchcock homage. Now, there's a lot of people who argue about whether it was basically a pastiche and an homage, or whether he was copying Hitchcock, whether he was just kind of slavishly imitating him, which rolls back into the Cahiers de Cinema stuff and the auteur theory and all sorts of things that I'm not really going to go into very much, except to say that I like the movie. Yes, there are the little nods to Hitchcock there, some more blatant than others, but basically I like the film a lot. I think it's funny. It's a very dark and mordant comedy in a lot of ways. And I wasn't expecting that when I first saw it too. I heard The Bride Wore Black. I knew it was an homage to Hitchcock. I knew the novel by Cornell Woolrich, which I'd read well before I knew there was a movie of it. And I went into it and I thought, oh, this is funny. And it's got a punchline at the ending, which is terrific. I love the punchline at the ending of this film, which kind of brings everything around to be perfect. I mean, the ending is kind of perfect. I really like that as well. Now, Jean Moreau, at the time she made this film, was 40 years old, and the character in the original work was much younger. But Truffaut acknowledges that, because there's the implication that right at the start, Julie tries to throw herself out of a window to commit suicide, but her mother stops her from doing that, and she decides she's going to move away. She tells her family she's moving away, she's going to get her head straight, and that kind of thing. Now, the implication there is that this happened many years after the death of her husband on their wedding day on the steps of the church. And she's taken time to get the money together and to get the willpower and to be determined to kill the five men that she blames for the death of her husband. Now, the death of her husband, as it turns out, and this isn't too much of a spoiler because there's some aspects of that I want to talk about. The death of her husband was more a stupid accident than an act of deliberate malice. And how much each of the different characters caused the death of her husband is very much in argument. Basically, what happened was there were five drunken guys playing around with a rifle in an upstairs window across the street from the church, and one of them, not realizing that the others had loaded a bullet into it, accidentally kills the husband. Of course, you could see this movie as an argument for gun control as well, because it does drive women to kill five different people. But that's basically the story. It's a dead simple narrative. It's one of the early films where women do go on a killing spree. And having Jean Moreau play that character makes it really interesting, because she's a very fine actress. And even though the argument could be made that she's slightly too old for the role, she does bring it across. It's almost like she's sleepwalking through what she does. She's very emotionally detached, but very methodical and opportunistic, and a killing machine in a very kind of subtle and sad way. Now, I'm going to play the trailer from the movie and then go back to talk about some of the other reasons why I like it.
A new film by Francois Truffaut. She was a bride when the violence happened. Now she's a widow, and it's going to happen again. Jean Moreau stars in The Bride Wore Black. The bride has five names. Five men. To love. To lure. To kill. Killed the groom made one mistake. should have killed the bride. François Truffaut's A Bride Wore Black.
I like that trailer, not because it's in any way accurate or says anything useful about the film, but because it makes it sound like a spaghetti western, which it definitely is not. Julie, the character, is really a damaged person in a lot of ways, but she does have an allure. I mean, obviously, Jean Moreau has a lot of is a very attractive woman, even at the age of 40, and her distance and her aloofness is seen as a challenge by some of the men that she approaches. The first one, she's at a party, and a character played by Claude Riche is about to get married, and they're having an engagement party for him. And she lures him out on a balcony and basically throws him over the edge, which is one, the first thing. She never kills them in the same way. That's the interesting thing about it. And then there's the kind of the saddest of the victims, which is a guy called Coral, played by Michel Bouquet, who's a bachelor, and he's very vain about combing his hair over a bald spot at the back. And he's lonely and sad and a bit pathetic, and she kind of romances him in some ways, invites him to a concert and goes back to his house and poisons him. So, yeah, and she approaches this very differently. She becomes whatever the guy needs. In the first case with the ladies' man, she becomes a very kind of forward and a bit sexually available, or seemingly sexually available. There's no indication at all that the bride isn't a virgin, which makes it even more interesting. But and with Coral, she becomes a kind of almost unattainably beautiful and charming and desirable woman. So she takes that approach with him. The third one is the character Moran, played by Michelle Lonsdale. He's a small-time politician. Michelle Lonsdale, you might remember from one of the worst of the James Bond films, Moonraker. He's the guy that played Drax in that. And this is him somewhat younger, playing a politician. The bride pretends to be his son's school teacher, arranges for the wife to travel to visit her mother after receiving a telegram that the mother's sick, which, of course, the bride has organized herself. And that one's a little bit implausible, the way she kills him. I won't spoil that, but the way she kills him is a little bit implausible. And she sets it up inadvertently so that the son of Moran's school teacher gets blamed for the murder, and then as she's traveling on to the next murder, she has to go and make a quick call to the police to tell them that to let the school teacher go because the school teacher isn't actually responsible. She gives them enough detail to know that, to let them know that somebody else did it. So she's very aware of collateral damage and doesn't want that to happen, even though she does, while the child is in the house, kill his father, which makes things a little morally dubious and problematic. But she's always very gentle and very kind to the little boy, and confuses him a bit by saying she's his school teacher when he knows that she's a bit different. And he just decides to play along with it for the duration until things get a little bit horrible. But so we do see one of the faults in this film, and there are a few faults in this film, is that we find out what actually happened a little bit early, before two or three of the murders take place. And that kind of maybe is a problem with the plotting. It would have been nice to bring that revelation closer to the end of the film, perhaps. But nonetheless, that happens. Julie then goes after the fourth guy, a junkyard owner, but he's arrested by the police just as she's about to shoot him. And so that one goes on hold. Now, the last one is the murder of an artist played by Charles Denner, a guy called Fergus, who has painted a series of paintings which strongly resemble her. Whether he kind of had seen her in the newspapers after her husband was killed or something like that, he seems to be obsessed with the image of her. And she pretends to be a model and poses for him. And during the that process, where there are some really nice-looking sketches and paintings of Jean Moreau done, he falls in love with her, and that causes her to have, in some ways, a crisis. She doesn't want these guys to fall in love with her at all. Even she wants to just have it quick and have it out of the way. But he paints a reclining nude of her on the wall alongside his daybed in his studio. And right at the start of the film, we see a repeated image of a painting of Jean Moreau's character, Julie, topless, being duplicated and printed out. And we only realise in retrospect that that particular image is being printed out so the police can tell what she looks like while they're searching for her. So there's a nice little piece with that in there. And that falling in love part is the thing that really sets her off in a different direction. She kind of has hesitations and kind of almost stumbles in her mission because of that. Not because, but she's particularly fallen in love with him. It's very dubious that this character can fall in love with anybody. But, there is that. And then there's a really nice coda at the end of the film, which gives it another humorous twist. Now, I like this film for a number of reasons. Seeing Jean Moreau as an avenging angel is good. And I even like the detail. I mean, one of the things I like about French movies of the 50s and 60s is the kitchens and the household stuff looks different and the telephones are different. And it's nice seeing various locations and villages and the way people were, the way schoolyards were and all that kind of thing. So I like all the background detail in that as well. And I do like Jean Moreau in this film, even though, as I said, you can make the argument that she's a little bit old for the role, though Truffaut does bridge that in some way. It really is a really nice bit of acting. And the over-the-top Bernard Herrmann music at first seems overwhelming. When I first hear it towards the start of the film, it does seem very overwhelming. But then as you get more into the mood of the film, I think it falls into place nicely and becomes a part of that Hitchcock homage. Now, of course, if Hitchcock hadn't made this film, he would have made an entirely different film. But there are various nods to Hitchcock's work. There's a piece set in a concert hall, for instance. There are little bits of Spellbound and other films and a little bit of Rear Window in some parts. And I do kind of acknowledge the fact that maybe this was Truffaut getting Hitchcock out of his system in a way. And because of that intense interview process that he had with Hitchcock in the writing of the book that he wrote, I think that he probably did need to kind of clear his palate by getting it all out of the way, get it done, and then move on to something else, which in this case was another Cornell Rawlich adaptation, Mississippi Mermaid, which I think had Jean-Paul Belmondo in it. I'm going to have to revisit that film. I have seen it many moons ago, but I do have to revisit it. But I like this film. I like the kind of focus that she has on avenging the death of her husband and how wrong she is in a number of ways. Some of the guys she kills aren't necessarily very responsible for it. There's only really one who in any way could be complicit in the murder, and that's the guy who pulls the trigger. But in spite of that, and again, that's a Hitchcock thing too, that moral ambiguity about the protagonist is a very Hitchcock kind of thing. But in spite of that, you kind of find yourself in that voyeuristic position of going, okay, how's she going to kill the next one? Who's the next one? What's he going to be like? How's she going to get to him? How's she going to kill him? And you get that voyeuristic thing from the audience where we kind of buy into the game and buy into what's happening there, even though it is very dodgy from a moral viewpoint. But there's not too much else to say about this film. I really do like it. I think it's a very accessible Truffaut film. And Jean Moreau, of course, is lovely in the film, and I really do like her in this one. And again, it's got that wonderful punchline right at the end, which, if you haven't seen it, I am not going anywhere near spoiling, but it really does work. And the other thing, too, I should mention before I wind up is, It's not a very gory film. At least several of the murders take place off screen, slightly off screen in some cases, but at least two of the murders take place off screen, and that still works regardless of that. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now. I want to get back. I'm going to talk about a much more recent film, which has influenced two TV series. It has been the source of two TV series, and really does show a good action story with a female protagonist. And that is 1990s Nikita, also known as La Femme Nikita. Oh, yes, and before I finish with The Bride Wore Black, and I'll keep doing these coders, I'm sorry about that. There, I did look up the connection between Kill Bill and The Bride Wore Black. And Tarantino claimed never to have seen The Bride Wore Black before he made Kill Bill, because he's not a big Truffaut fan. And I can kind of believe him on that, because he is much more a Jean-Luc Godard kind of guy than a Truffaut kind of guy. Though he may well have seen the film and just forgotten about it as well. There's always that possibility. But while it does share a couple of similar themes with The Bride Wore Black, Kill Bill is a totally different kind of film and doesn't have anything that I can see that's an overt homage to Truffaut's movie. So anyway, when I'm back, we're going to be looking at La Femme Nikita.
Je suis indolente, mes yeux sont vagues, vagues, vagues. Je balance mes hanches vaguement. Mes lèvres remuent, fardées de mots si vagues, vagues. Les passants hésitent en me croisant. Le temps maudit toujours les presses. Le temps si lent pour celle qui attend. Le temps me berce de paresse, alors je chante sans fin ce vague chant. Les jeux de l'amour sont comme les jeux du hasard, qui rêve de cœur souvent est servi de pique noire, qui cherche un regard reçoit des rires moqueurs. Les hommes nonchalants me font des signes vagues, vagues, et me frôlent de l'épaule vaguement. Une étreinte vague entre deux êtres vagues, vagues, c'est un peu renier le néant. Le temps maudit toujours nous presse, le temps pourtant qui va si lentement. Le temps efface mes caresses, alors je chante sans fin ce vague chant. Les jeux de l'amour sont comme les jeux du hasard, qui rêve de cœur souvent est servi de pique noire, qui cherche un regard reçoit des rires moqueurs. Et je suis si triste quand les hommes vagues, vagues, vagues se reposent dans mes bras vaguement. Vaguement divaguent dans leur sommeil si vague, vague. Quand ils dorment, ils ressemblent aux enfants. Le temps maudit toujours m'oppresse, le temps qui va son lent balancement. Le temps emporte ma tendresse, alors je chante sans fin ce vague chant. Les jeux de l'amour sont comme les jeux du hasard, qui rêve de cœur souvent est servi de pique noire, qui cherche un regard reçoit des rires moqueurs.
That was Les Blues Indolents by Jean Moreau again, otherwise known as Lazy Blues. So it's on to 1990, a very different time to 1968 when The Bride Wore Black was made, and a very different director and writer for this film in Luc Besson. Truffaut was, of course, part of the French New Wave, the Nouvelle Vague, and Luc Besson was part of a briefly lived movement around the late 80s and early 90s called Cinéma du Look, which basically was style over substance. That was a deliberate choice that these guys made. They wanted to have a lot of high culture and pop culture references in the movies. And basically they focused on young alienated characters who were said to represent the marginalized youth of François Mitterrand's France. I'm reading this off Wikipedia, by the way. I don't have it at my fingertips and at the tip of my brain lots of things about French film movement, so I'm trying to come across as smarter than I am. But, yeah, the cinema to look is style over substance, young alienated people, a kind of music video look to the films. And Luc Besson obviously has carried that on. If you have a look at something like Lucy, it's very much cinema to look brought forward 25 years, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I like his transporter movies. I like this one. I like The Professional as well, with Jean Reno, who appears in this film as well as a cleaner. Not in the usual sense of a cleaner, but somebody who comes in and fixes up problems when an assassination attempt goes wrong. But the cast is very good. Anne Parillo, who was married to Luc Besson, he's got a tendency to marry women from his movies, does Mr. Besson. Let's have a look at who he married. Anne Parillo, they divorced. Maywenn Lebesco, who played the blues-singing opera diva Alien in The Fifth Element, he married her. Mila Jovovich he married as well between 1997 and 1995. And his current wife, Virginie Silla. I don't know whether she was in anything. Nope, she's a French film producer, so obviously he's moved on from actresses to producers now. But I do like the works of Luc Besson. I do like kind of sitting back and just enjoying that style of substance. And Nikita is definitely that. It's very gritty. And, yeah, as I said, it has inspired two TV series, one that started in 1997 with Peter Wilson in it, and a 2010 TV series starring Maggie Q, which kind of watered down this one pretty much. Now, the film starts with Nikita, played by Anne Parillo, who's a teenage junkie who's participates in a robbery in a pharmacy. Again, I'm going reading from Wikipedia. A pharmacy owned by a friend's parents. The robbery goes awry and there's a lot of gunfire. Two cops get killed and then she shoots the third one under the chin with a pistol. She's strung out and in a very bad way. She's arrested, tried and sentenced to life imprisonment. Along comes a very well-dressed, nasty guy called Bob, played by Chick Icario, the Turkish-born French actor who you've seen in any number of things. He played one of the scientists in one of my favourite bad science fiction movies from the last decade, which was The Core. And I like Chick Icario in this. He does bring across the hardness. And he works for a government agency known as the Centre. And basically tells her she's going to become an assassin for the Centre and it's going to be her life from now on. He trains her for 3 years. And in a number of different things, computer technology, guns, weapons, fighting, all sorts of things. And she does show an incredible aptitude for the fighting part, particularly when she nearly bites the ear off one of her karate instructors. She's a very hardcore person. She's feral. She's nasty. She's really doesn't have any sense of herself and basically is incredibly punk and nihilistic and just has no sense of the future. And Anne Parillo does play that pretty well. She really does kind of come across as all bravado and nastiness. And I think that's one of the things that carries this film across very well. Very attractive actress, but she did play really mean and nasty. And then the Centre gets hold of her and has to kind of knock off the rough edges without losing the hardness on her. And that's done mostly by Bob, but with the help of another character that we saw in a previous movie. Well, we didn't see the character, but we saw the person. Jean Moreau playing Amand, one of her trainers, who basically trains her in how to be a seductress and how to be attractive to men. And she has some nice scenes. Jean Moreau, much older, of course, at this time than she was when she made The Bride Wore Black. But nonetheless, really bringing across that presence that she has and that elegance that she has in that in her interactions with Nikita in this film. And I was thinking about the two movies back-to-back, and I thought, I wonder if Aman, the female trainer from Nikita, may well be Julie Kohler from The Bride Wore Black, who was in jail at the end of the film. And maybe she was rescued by the centre and recruited into being first an assassin and a trainer. How's that for linking the two films together? It's just a little conceit that I thought up while I was on my morning walk this morning around the beach. But, and the thing is that this film, of course, has a lot of action in it. It's not all action, but it has plenty of action in it. She then becomes a sleeper agent with a set-up life in Paris, and she, of course, has no idea on how to live her life. She hasn't actually functioned as an adult before. And she meets Marco, played by Jean-Hugues Anglade, in a supermarket, and he becomes her boyfriend and then her fiancé and knows nothing about her real life. I mean, he's curious about her lack of a past and her lack of friends and things. But they do love each other, and his sense of humour and his kind of humanity brings Nikita, who has changed her name for the purposes of this thing. Her code name is Josephine, but her name is Marie. And she and he set up house, they decorate the flat, they start living a life together, and then she gets a call to do a job. And she gets that a number of times, all of which not only does it threaten her life, but it also threatens her relationship and this life that she's built for herself with her fiancé, Marco. And that's part of the wonder of this film, and I really like it for that reason. I like the fact that she is damaged goods at the start, and she's in the, you see the process of her being healed, partly by herself, partly by Marco, and being trained by Bob. Now, Bob's one of those names that French people think is the go-to name for any tough guy. There's Bob le Flambeur, and it's just one of those names that French people think is a tough American name. That's why Checky Carrio's character is called Bob in the film. Now, Bob then turns up at the apartment and pretends to be her uncle, so that Marco can meet some of her family, and also because he's setting them up to do a job in Venice, setting her up to do a job in Venice. So he pretending to be Uncle Bob, the travel agent, gives them tickets to a holiday in Venice, and then Nikita has to commit an assassination there, which kind of blows up a bit, and then gets a very big job in Paris again, which kind of brings things to a head in a lot of ways. So that's pretty much it as far as the story is concerned, but it really does have some wonderful moments in it. There's Nikita / Marie trying to balance this new life she's got with her old life. And the interesting thing is, even when she is dressed up to the nines, there's still a little bit of that kind of swaggering, punkish strut that she had at the start of the film in the body language that she brings to the character, and I do like that a lot. There's a lot of gun porn in it if you're into handguns and sniper rifles and things like that. There's a lot of that in there. There's some beautiful location shooting as well, both gritty kind of suburban location shooting and around Paris and in Venice, all that kind of thing. So you've got all of that kind of cinematic eye candy to play with. And then you've got Victor the Cleaner, played by Jean Reno, who comes in and is a bull in a china shop and basically kills everybody again. You first see him he's dragging two corpses by their feet, one foot in each hand, into an apartment that she's in, and dumps all of them in the bathtub and starts burning them with acid, which goes comically wrong. And there are some weirdly funny bits in this. But Victor, the cleaner, trying to clean up the bodies by dissolving them in acid in a bathtub, is a kind of nastily, wonderfully, over-the-top, violent, funny piece in this film. But again, it comes down to how well Ann Paralow plays Nikita, and I think she's really, really good in this. I think that she's not necessarily the kind of a very attractive woman, but her face doesn't have what would be considered an Anglo beauty about it. She's got a very Gallic beauty to her face, and I kind of like that as well. This movie, of course, was remade as Point of No Return with Bridget Fonda in about 1993, directed by John Badham. In Australia, it was called The Assassin, and I don't think it's as good. I mean, Roger Ebert has said it's almost as good as Nikita, but I've really got to disagree. I think the original's the best, and everything else is a increasingly fading photocopy. And this movie is the one to go to. Even though I did like Bridget Fonda in Jackie Brown, and I said so on the radio when I was talking about it the other night, I don't think it really works as well without the French context. And the other thing about it is the kind of moral grey areas, again, like The Bright World Black, the moral grey areas Nikita's in. She doesn't really know why some of the assassinations are taking place. There's one, the one in Venice, for instance. She doesn't know the reason for that. She isn't told the reason for that. It's one of those need-to-know kind of things. All she needs to know is she's got to be in a certain place at a certain time and kill a certain person under instruction from a headset and a radio that she's got. Now, again, she has no idea of who that person is or what they've done, just that she needs to do it. And she's trained very well to do it. There's a few, there's that action scene. There's one taking place in a very expensive restaurant and in the kitchens of the very expensive restaurant, which is very well laid out. But the thing I keep going back to is how many times Nikita is betrayed by people. I mean, her dumb boyfriend who's trying to get her drugs at the start dies and has kind of dragged her into this stupid situation of trying to rob a pharmacy. She's betrayed a number of times by Bob in the most cruel ways possible. Just when she thinks things are going okay and Bob does like her and you know there's a fondness between them, Bob's motives are something entirely businesslike. And Chick Icario plays that really well. He plays Bob very charming but rough. And then there are these betrayals of Nikita, the person, which are heartbreaking to her. And really, yeah, he even shoots her right at the start just to kind of tell her how serious he is. He shoots her in the leg, just not through the bone, but just through a flesh wound kind of thing. But that's the kind of guy he is. It's a little bit like that bit at the start of Battle Royale where Takeshi Kitano proves to the students how serious he is by throwing a knife into the head of one of the students. It's that level of, I'm not fucking around here, that Chick Icario brings to the character of Bob. I would like to see another movie with Bob in it. I don't mind. I would love to see another movie with Bob in it because Bob's such an interesting character. And again, there's that wonderful style over substance that is a characteristic of Luc Besson's work. Though I do think that, particularly given that Ann Paralow does so well as Nikita, I think there is a lot of substance here as well. Even though the cinema de look thing says style over substance, the substance here and the arc of the character and the kind of awakening of the character is a very important aspect of this film, which really can't be underestimated. Now, of course, there are a number of tough, kick-ass women in the oeuvre of Luc Besson. Of course, there's Lucy. There's also Natalie Portman's character in Léon, the professional, and a number of other kind of really tough, action-oriented female characters, which is all credit to him. And, of course, we've also got The Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec as another example of strong female characters in Luc Besson's work. I mean, of course, he has done other things as well. He did write the first couple, I think, of the Taken movies. He did the three Transporter movies with Jason Statham. And, of course, he's produced the Transporter TV series, which is still going and is kind of cool, and I enjoy that a lot as well. But I'm going to have to kind of adopt the phrase cinema de look for those movies that are style over substance. I mean, there's also probably cinema de superhero look where the style is all over the substance as well. But this film, I did have a copy of it. I found a copy of it that I have, but it's in that old CD, video CD format where you had to have two video CDs for one film before DVD came out. I've got an old video CD version of this that I could have brought out and watched, but instead I got out my DVD version and watched that as well. So the film, I mean, I like a good action film. I particularly like a good action film, which, as do the films of Luc Besson, in the same way that John Woo does, where the action in the film is determined by the things you would naturally find in the environment that it's set in. So the things you naturally find in a kitchen are the things that they use if they're fighting in a kitchen. The things you'd naturally find in a welder's workshop would be the things that they'd use in a welder's workshop. And that kind of stuff, I really like that, where they, obviously somebody, maybe the writer, stands in the middle of a room and says, what would I use in a fight in this one? I'm looking around the man cave and I could have a fucking nasty fight with stuff in the man cave, mostly because on the bookshelf over there I've got two machetes to start off with. But it's that kind of stuff that I really like. I like a nice action scene, and I like a nice action scene that makes sense in context as well. And the thing that these two characters have in common are strong female roles. Yes, the women kill people, but it's not always their fault. And at least one of them is probably clinically insane. But just to wrap things up, Jean Moreau, movie goddess, Luc Besson, great action film director and a writer of action films. French movies kick ass in a number of ways. If you're looking for... Somebody mentioned on Facebook the other day that they were looking for some good car chases in American action films. And I said, you don't go to American action films for good non-CGI car chases these days. You go to French films and look at the stuff that they're doing in Europe. And that's where the good stuff is. That's where the real action is as far as car chase movies is concerned. And it has been probably since Remy Julien started in the 1960s and did the Italian Job. They're the guys to go to for that kind of an action film. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I want to get back. There's a little tiny bit of feedback from our mate Morris, who's always loyal and true in this regard. And I'll wrap things up with the usual begging for pennies via the Patreon campaign.
Hooray for Hollywood, that screwy booey hooey Hollywood, where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan. And any barmaid can be a star maid if she dances with or without a fan. Hooray for Hollywood, where you're terrific if you're even good, where anyone at all from Sophie Loren to Mame Van Doren is equally understood. Go out and try your luck, you may be Donald Duck. Hooray for Hollywood. Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan. And any barmaid
maid can be a star made if she dances with or without a fan. Whoever Hollywood, you may be homely in your neighborhood, but if you think that you can be an actor, go see Max Factor. He'll make your kisser look good. He'll send you off in space. You'll dig this crazy place.
That was Anita O'Day with Hooray for Hollywood, a tune that I should have played in the podcast much earlier than I have, because it seems to be what things are about here. But anyway, I did get a message from our friend Morris from Love That Album podcast, amongst others, who said thank you for me reminding him about Newsfront, the Australian film I mentioned last time around in the podcast. Yeah, that's okay, Morris. Newsfront is a fantastic Australian film. I've seen it twice in the last year, and I still love it. It's a great film. It says a lot about a lot of things, as I said last podcast. But, yeah, thanks for that, mate. And we will have to catch up for coffee. Morris and I regularly catch up for coffee and spend about 20, 25 minutes cramming information about podcasting at each other and movies and other stuff at an enormous bandwidth. So we should do that again soon, mate. But anyway, I'm going to leave you, of course, with the usual credits in the style of movie credits to thank the people who've donated to the podcast through the Patreon campaign. You can do it for as little as a dollar per month, which, well, you can figure out how much that is a day. But anyway, I'll leave that with you. I'll be back next week with a Martian Driving podcast and next fortnight with another Paleo Cinema podcast. Look after yourselves, watch good movies, and take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Again, thanks to all of the lovely people who support the podcast through the Patreon campaign. And as usual, in the manner of movie credits, here are their names and their jobs in the mythical Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In movie. Thank you to Alyssa the Location Scout, Tansy the Foley Artist, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Christopher the Gaffer, Chris the Camera Operator, Julia the Casting Director, Elaine, the Scientific Advisor, Matt, the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Armin, the Key Grip, Jan, the Dialect Coach, Morris, the Musical Director, Gary, the Prop Master, Tom, the Focus Puller, Sarah, the Special Effects Technician, Ian, the Caterer, Grant, the Technicolor Consultant, and our newest supporter, Claire, the Script Doctor. So thank you very much to all of those people, and if you'd like to join them on the credits, go to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd also like to thank Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost and his muse, and also to Mr. Debussy for playing his music, The Gollywog's Cakewalk. I'll see you all again soon.